The EMS Garage welcomes your input, www.emsgarage.com. You can interact with us via email, emsgarage@gmail.com, or you can call us at 206-984-1622. That's 206-984-1622.
The EMS Garage.
Well, hello everybody and welcome to the EMS Garage. This is episode 21. We're going to talk about the NTSB hearings. We're going to talk about a new podcast that we're working on. And then I'm sure you'll have some good witty humor and banter from the rest of us. So joining me tonight, I'm going to go through the list very quickly because we have a full podcast. We have Stacy Friedman from SafeFlightMed.org. Is that right?
It's actually SafeMedFlight.
Ah, I always mess that up. I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
Ah, SafeMedFlight.org. Is that right?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Great.
All right. And we have Gary Wingrove, the ever traveling, but not this week, Gary Wingrove.
Howdy.
Will Dunn from the Frozen Tundra / you know, you actually had you sent us a flow chart, and I heard this week that you really love Visio in Microsoft, and I'm going to send you a Father's Visio Will Dunn only Visio chart. So welcome, Will Dunn.
Thank you very much.
And also joining us, Skip Kirkwood.
Hey, gang.
And Gary Freeze for the first time. Hello, sir. How are you? We're going to talk about...
This is Greg Freeze.
Greg Freeze. I'm sorry. Not Gary.
That's all
not
right.
Gary.
Ah. I'm glad to be here.
See, I mess up everybody.
And I'm in Wisconsin where it is not frigid cold. It was 50 degrees today, second day in a row.
I know. Aaron told me in Minnesota it was raining.
That's So the global warming folks are correct? Is that it?
Let's not confuse climate with weather.
Thank you. Very smart. we have another new guest tonight on the garage, Dr. Brian Bledsoe. Hello, sir.
How are you doing? I hope I make it through this. I'm at my Texas house today, and the weather is turning bad. We're under a tornado watch. So if I disappear, listen for wind.
Okay. Well,
You don't have broadband in your tornado shelter?
Well, actually, I do have broadband, and we do have a Kevlar tornado shelter, but, you know, every time I try to get my wife to go in there, she thinks I'm up to something, so it was hard to get her in there.
Oh, for the third week in a row, we just lost our iTunes clean tag. And we also have Aaron Reinert tonight from Minnesota. Hello, sir.
Minnesota.
Yeah. Minnesota. And Kathy Etter. And I will never say Eater again, I promise.
Oh, you got it right, Etter.
I know. That's why I said I'll never say Eater again. I learned my lesson on episode 18 or whatever.
I'm used to it.
I know, but it's so weird. It doesn't even have an A in it. I don't know why I would mess that up. So welcome you. Welcome
everybody.
Everybody
does that. Thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you for joining us on this special Valentine's edition. Everybody's in love. Oh, we all love everybody. And so first thing I wanted to talk about this week very, very quickly, because I know Greg is running off to talk on a different podcast at the very same time. It's Jamie's podcast over there, mediccast.com. He's a pretty good guy. So, Greg, tell us about the new thing we're going to start next week.
Well, Chris, after listening to you for several weeks, I thought we should have a EMS education podcast, and so I sent you an email, and one thing led to another, and you and I are... putting our heads together about a couple other people that could join us as guests to talk about all things EMS education. And we want to make sure, just like the garage, that it's entertaining and interesting. but maybe from user or listener feedback and questions, we can talk about things related to EMS education, whether it be in the classroom for initial training, refresher or recertification training, even that on-the-job training that comes with being a preceptor. And so I'm looking forward to talking EMS education with you. And like I said, we're maybe looking for a couple other voices that could join in with us and have a conversation.
Well, and I know we've exchanged emails quite a bit this week, and we had an email this week from a guy named Jeff, and he was asking us, we should really focus a couple shows about the EMS education for the future and the EMS agenda for the future and some of the ways EMS education and EMT education is changing in the United States. And boy, I think that would be a perfect forum for that, because A, I know nothing about EMS education, and B, I'll just be there to drive the questions just like on the garage. So join us next week. We'll add one or two episodes of the EMS Education Podcast into your feed, and we hope that you can join us for that. I'm very excited about that. I think it's going to be fun. And as Skip said, I have a 2.0 UHU, and we'll at least try it for a while and see, hope it works. We've also got one more podcast in the mix coming up soon, so we'll give you more information when that launches. So thanks, Greg. Do you want to join us for a little bit longer? Are you going to run over to the Medicast there?
Yeah, I'll hang on for a little bit. You know, Dr. Bledsoe said if we hear wind, something's happened, but I've been at several of his lectures, and I've always heard a lot of wind.
Oh, wow.
Wait, 20, mark the time, 38 seconds into the podcast, the first shot's been fired.
That's great.
Now, Greg, I know where you
live. This isn't even a record, really.
Chris earlier told me that I had to try to be funny, so.
Oh, that was great. That was perfect.
Okay.
Oh, man. Well, and if nothing else, it made me laugh. So, hey, that was great.
I'd prefer that you do mime.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's good. Wow. I don't know how well that translates in an audio podcast.
That's the point.
Oh, wow. See, again,
it's the humor.
Oh, humor, right. It gets me. Well, you know, talking about some of these good things, Dr. Bledsoe and Stacy and Gary, you were all a part of those NTSB hearings. Does one of you want to take the lead and maybe give us a little bit of background on it and then tell us what happened here recently with the NTSB hearings?
Loaded question.
Yeah, I know it is. Stacy, do you want to tell us a little bit maybe about where it started?
Well, I can certainly do that, and I'm probably going to defer to Gary and Brian, but I have a different perspective having come with 22 other family members to that hearing, and those are family members who lost brothers, sisters, spouses, children in these accidents. And most of us were 2005 or later, so the most recent accident was 3 months prior to the hearings. And as a group, this is the first time that we had ever gotten together face-to-face. We've done a lot of emailing and so forth, but after the Maryland crash, and there was an announcement sort of informally that there would be these hearings, some of the family members wrote to the NTSB and requested we sort of knew the protocol would be no family member participation, because that's how that works. And we requested a private meeting prior to the actual hearing so that we could have some input from our perspective. And we were granted that meeting on Monday, the day before the hearings. And then the hearings were what they were. And then we used that opportunity to go to Capitol Hill and push for additional legislation, basically safety, aviation transportation safety language, and a new bill in the House. So that's my experience of who we were and what we were there for. How the hearings played out was incidental, truthfully, to us being there, because our expectations were managed and we knew what to expect.
So, Gary, from the legislature or legislative side, what did you see as far as, you know, some of the backroom kind of lobbyist stuff going on? And was there any surprises?
I don't know if I saw any surprises. The process was interesting for me. I haven't attended a TSB hearing before. And as I described last week, on our podcast that was a little bit different, and actually I think at some point it would be nice to use that format at some EMS conference to kind of debate an issue. I think that would be good. There were, and I had to miss part of the hearings as well because I was on the Hill. I actually missed Dr. Bledsoe completely. I got to see him over the internet when I got back to my hotel room for a little bit, so I'm interested in what happened in his portion. But they had a situation where they set up various panels that had some expertise in an area, and then some parties to the hearing got a chance to ask questions, and then an investigative panel could, and then finally the NTSB members themselves. So it was an interesting process. There were several high points. I haven't seen the last day of video yet. I'm downloading it now. And I understand there were some interesting things that went on that last day, but I can't comment on them because I don't know what they were. We had the ability to have one of our physicians on a panel, Dr. Dan Hankins, and that panel was interesting. One of the members, Sumwalt, from the NTSB, made a comment. Dr. Hankins was on the panel along with another gentleman from one of the other national air ambulance companies, and it was kind of a panel that had the spectrum of what goes on in air medical. The units that we fly are $7 million helicopters that have terrain avoidance warning systems and collision avoidance systems and night vision goggles and kind of the whole ball of wax. They're pretty much outfitted like a 737 that you might fly in. And then on the other end of the panel was a provider who had helicopters that flew VFR only, and they were really the two extremes. So that was there was some interesting dialogue there, some great questions that came out of that session.
I have to say that was probably the best session.
So what
in terms of information that, you know, that was gleamable or valuable to anyone in the audience.
So what happened in that session, do you think?
Well, I think you got to see the spectrum of what's out there. And so you got to see a best practice kind of situation. And then, while not maybe a best practice, certainly a different practice.
You know, yeah. And that really got illustrated to me. I just got an email over the weekend from a friend of mine. It showed me some photos from a bird strike from a helicopter out of Arkansas, I believe. And it looked like there was probably multiple bird strikes to this helicopter that forced it to land. And what was shocking to me is that service does not wear helmets as a matter of routine when they're And I had no idea there was such a disparity because it never even occurred to me that there would be an air service that would fly without helmets. But apparently
they're not required.
Yeah, I was stunned when I heard that, so I can appreciate how that would probably be a very eye-opening session to see something from, multi-million-dollar helicopters to what sounds like hillbilly air.
I have to say that based on what Aaron was saying, the thing that really stood out at the hearings, and I was testifying before the panel that was related to oversight of helicopters and competition, but the real thing that was eye-opening was the difference between the for-profit, for the most part, and not-for-profit operators. The first thing the NTSB did were bring in the Canadians. You know, the Canadians operate 20 helicopters in their country of 30 million, and they've flown over 300,000 flight hours without a single fatality. Of course, they fly full VFR, dual-pilot, minimal night-flight aircraft. But you actually had one chief pilot on the panel that that Gary was talking about, saying they use a Garmin 396 GPS unit, and that's just as good as TAWS. And and you know, the whole hearing was almost adversarial in a way, in that it was loaded with people from Ames. I mean, they were giving press releases every day. Every panel had an Ames member. And basically the mantra was, we can regulate ourselves. We don't need oversight. It's really not that dangerous, and go on about your business. It was almost disconcerting.
Dr. Bledsoe, it's no secret that you've been very outspoken about at least the Maryland crash. What is your general feeling about where this is going in the future of air medical safety?
Well, I think, first of all, I want to say this. Helicopters are very important. You know, 10 years ago in this country, we had 200 or 300 helicopters, and I think that was a reasonable number. Now we're at like 870. I think that the changes in funding that occurred in 2001 allowed this for-profit component to come in. And if you look back at the history of medicine over the last 30 years, if you remember back in the 1980s, the big thing was boutique psychiatric hospitals, and all of a sudden everybody needed a psychiatric diagnosis to be admitted, and that got abused and went away because, and it happened because the reimbursement was good. In the 1990s, it was home health care. Everybody needed home health care. You'd get requests in the emergency department for wheelchairs for patients with grade 2 ankle sprains. Well, this time, it's the helicopters, and it's an industry out of control. We absolutely need it. You know, I was actually critical long before the Maryland program. In fact, I've always kind of held the Maryland program up as being a pretty good model, although I was on the expert panel that reviewed them in November, and certainly they've got issues. But, I actually jokingly said in some interviews with the national media, there are more helicopters in Dallas-Fort Worth or more helicopters, medical helicopters, in Phoenix than there are all of Canada. And that played out in this NTSB hearings in D.C. It was truly an awakening. It was really disconcerting to me because, it's not okay. 29 dead. Just ask Stacy. I met the families. I've known a lot of these people who died because I travel so much. And, yeah, it may be an actuarial number to some, for-profit helicopter operation, but to the patients and the families, this is their kindred. And you forget that sometimes, and it gets lost in numbers and statistics.
Now,
that was really the point, too, for us to go, was to show some faces to some statistics and not to be victims or martyrs, but to just say, these numbers are people, and these people made a huge difference in their lives, made a difference to other people, but just by their chosen profession, and we just have to lay down that respect and to say enough is enough.
Do you feel that maybe some of the air medical providers I've heard say they're on a witch hunt? They're after us. They're after our business model. They don't understand. Yes, it's all risky, but I mean, yeah. what do you have to say about that?
We hear that all the time. But we also hear that as family members, we have no right to get involved in any kind of congressional legislation because we couldn't possibly understand the complexities of aviation, so we should shut up. They're not everyone, but there are people out there that are always going to be critical of anybody who's going to advocate a different position, but then there are others, some on this panel, who are willing to listen and to understand that we've educated ourselves to a great degree, and we're kind of fed up. And I think that when you get to a critical mass like we have, and even though 28 people is in a critical mass, when you start adding it up, since 2001, there have been 141 fatalities and 36 serious injuries on both fixed wing and rotorcraft. So those numbers are exponential, and that's a lot of families.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
Throw in a different perspective.
Sure.
As this is the other Aaron.
Actually, I'm Stacy.
Okay.
My sister was Aaron.
As the question around the witch hunt has come up, one of the things that I think is important to remember is, as an ambulance provider, we often are calling the air ambulances, and I'm often worried that we'll ultimately become responsible if there is some kind of unfortunate crash. So as a provider, I'm really excited about this process of asking the hard questions around what is required and what is the standards and what is safe, so that I feel comfortable when I'm in that roadside or at that car accident and we request a service, and there are in my area two or three that I could pick from, that I feel comfortable that the one I picked will be able to safely deliver that patient to the trauma center, and that doesn't exist today. So
Well, that's really too bad that as a you probably have, I'm going to guess, about 30 other things that you'd rather have to worry about on that scene.
Absolutely.
I mean, that really is kind of a sad testament that you are almost putting yourself into a moral bind on trying to use a resource that's in your area. I mean, that's I mean, I think that that's just unfathomable.
For the record, in my case, the three air providers that are in our area are absolutely outstanding, but that's not the case elsewhere. And I know in talking to other providers that they think through those questions of, okay, am I deciding based on who came and gave me the biggest bucket of popcorn and the most hats and free stuff, mm-hmm. or am I deciding because it's a multi-engine, two-pilot, TCAS kind of craft, and today, without, you know, somehow getting all of that knowledge, it doesn't exist. And so I think this process is excellent.
That kind of came up in my testimony in the panel that I was on, in that, you know, 10 years ago, when you called an air medical provider, and in Dallas-Fort Worth at that time, it was primarily CareFlight, you know, you knew what you got. I never hesitated to turn over my most complicated emergency department patient to a care flight crew to go to wherever they were going. Nowadays, it's a crapshoot. The quality of provider and equipment varies significantly from service to service. And this idea of what was mentioned earlier about freelancing, that is basically, you know, call your buddy, call who brings you the popcorn, call who gives you the landing fee, is not right. The whole system needs to be like Maryland, in that it's all under a centralized communications, and there needs to be stratification in terms of quality of care. Is it just a simple ALS provider? Is it a little more advanced? Do they have ECMO? Do they have high-frequency ventilation? Are they carrying blood? There is an organization that's basically formed that was a spinoff from the not-for-profit providers that propose exactly that, stratification. And another thing that came up at the NTSB hearings is the stratification of aircraft based on avionics. For example, you're in an area where you call and VFR conditions are marginal, but there happens to be a service in your community that has full IFR. You know, they should be called. But the problem is now the industry does not want any sort of centralized dispatch. They want this free market, sort of free for all. You know, like the ambulance business was when I got into it in the 1970s. You know, it was rough and tumble, you know, chase the calls, park your ambulance behind the others so they can't get their stretcher out, and, you know, almost fist fights.
Can I ask a question of Aaron? Is it Aaron?
Yeah.
So you're a ground provider, and you call for service, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Where would your, and this is just my ignorance, and I'm trying to educate other people, where would your liability come from if you called, you know, and I'm not going to use your words, but a service that perhaps couldn't provide the critical care needs of the patient that you were seeing? I mean, how would that put in liability against you or your service?
Yeah, excellent question. Not being a lawyer, you know, I don't know all the details, but here's my experience, not obviously in a case of an air medical accident, but my organization, small, non-for-profit ambulance, not covered by any tort caps in our state, has less than 50 full-time employees, a few million-dollar budget, has been involved in some lawsuits over time where our resources are drained just defending ourselves when a lawyer throws out a suit just to see if somebody would settle. So that's really my concern, is not whether or not we'll necessarily be liable, but what's to prevent anybody from bringing a civil suit against us because we were the experts and we should have known better in selecting air service A over air service B. I'd even go far, and this will go on a little bit of a limb here, but it would be outstanding, again, from a ground provider standpoint, to have air medical providers maybe even categorized like we do trauma centers. And so I would know if I'm getting a level one helicopter, they've met these certain kind of standards. And as the doc was saying, are they ECMO capable, or is it EMT? I mean, what are their capabilities? That would make me feel really comfortable that I'm providing the best possible care for the patient, knowing what they can provide.
But it probably wouldn't help you in a liability situation.
Yeah, lawsuits are like seizures. You can have one any reason at any time.
But so even if you followed the correct levels of care, you would still be liable if, in fact, that superior care service crashed.
Let me stick my lawyer in here for a second.
We do have a lawyer.
The possibility of being able to establish proximate cause between a decision to call an air medical provider and an injury that actually happens is pretty remote. Mm-hmm. But Aaron makes a very good point that you can be, you know, like most private people will win the lawsuit brought against them and bankrupt themselves doing so.
That's
very real.
Well, Skip, that being said, just 2 weeks ago, I looked at a petition of discovery from ambulance service, a not-for-profit ambulance service in South Texas, that was indeed sued, and it's still in the discovery phase. For they called a helicopter to pick up a patient with chest pain. The helicopter crash killed the paramedic, the nurse, and the pilot. And the family of the paramedic is suing the service, which was actually a branch of the service that operated the helicopter, for calling for a patient that probably didn't require a medical transport. So that's the second suit like that I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt there will be those suits. The prevailing in a suit like that is pretty remote.
Because you
got to hook the decision to call to the events that caused the helicopter to fall from the sky, and that's way remote. But you got to defend. I mean, if you're looking at discovery, somebody's spending hundreds or thousands of dollars per hour in process that some small nonprofit or privately owned organization does not have to spend.
Right. Well, thanks for clarifying that, because I think important.
The other piece that will haunt the EMS agencies involved. EMS providers are very, you know, they're very passionate folk, and they will hold themselves to a standard of liability in their hearts that a court would never hold them to. Now, they will feel, you know, they will make that decision, and the fine points of proximate cause will be lost on them, and they and their organization and their friends will all feel like, well, gee, if I had just known a little bit more about helicopters, I could have avoided this. From my perspective, managing the crisis in the sky from on the ground, with a single exception, is not the solution to the problem.
Yeah, one of the common mantras I hear when I travel, and it was also brought up several times at the NTSB hearings, is, well, we call the helicopter, we provide the helicopter, because if the ambulance takes a patient to the hospital, they're out of service for 2 hours. And while that seems, you know, kind of emotionally very good, but ethically it's horrible. Because what you're saying is, here is a patient who probably did not need helicopter transport, but because we don't have enough ambulances in our county, we're going to put them on the helicopter. And so you're making this ill or injured patient assume the extra risk of air medical transport, and plus the cost, which is going to be 10 times that of ground transport. And people do that, and they recite that mantra without any thought. And to me, that's just so ethically wrong. And you know, the solution is to properly equip and staff and provide the ground ambulances, not to cost shift the burden to the patient via helicopter transport. It's a non sequitur.
Well, why is it, and this is not the only scenario where this dilemma comes up, why is it we have such difficulty getting the men and women who work for us on our ambulances to understand their obligation is to treat the patient that they have right now in their face at the present time, not the one that might happen at some later time or date? Why do they feel that we expect them to be the guardians of the system and get away from the present patient in the interest of the patient that might happen in the next 2 hours?
Yeah, the best call you got's the one you're on.
You know, it's not just paramedics. I had the problems with physicians. I ran two emergency departments, had about 12 physician employees, and all they knew is if they called the helicopter, they'd get the patient out of 3B immediately and open it up for the next patient, whereas if they had to wait for the grand ambulance, it took a while. They lose sight of the cost, the risk, and all they care about is getting to the next patient because hospital administration or the ER contract group is pushing them to see, you know, 2.0 patients per hour. It's like an ambulance UHU, except for it's patients per hour. So it's not just paramedics. But, you know, another thing, I think that for some reason through our educational process, and God, I hope it's not the textbooks, but some reason we've taught them that, you can always call the helicopter. And when you look at a helicopter, it provides two things. It provides speed, and in some cases, it provides quality of care. And a lot of instances of quality of care is not much different than what's available on the ground. So it comes down to speed. And what we're learning from OPALS and the study that Peter Pons did is that speed makes less difference. And certainly there are time-sensitive lesions such as STEMIs and things of that nature, but you have to consider both. You know, if they need speed, they need high-quality care. But if they just need high-quality care, they don't necessarily need speed, and a grand ambulance will suffice. But it gets tied up in the emotion, and I don't know. It's gotten in the culture.
Well, I
have not been able to get the speed thing out of my head because, now, admittedly, I've not been in the sort of the outer ring environment very much where the flight time is going to be 90 minutes from a scene to a hospital. But every time I've seen a helicopter employed with sort of great hope that speed will happen, that the helicopter will land, the patient will be placed on board, and the helicopter will depart, you know, I don't even see that benefit happen. I see ground times of 15, 20, 25, 30, 35 minutes while, I mean, you know, I've only been a medic for 28 years and in EMS for 35 years, but what I see going on in that interval, I can only characterize as putzing around. And within a certain distance, you've erased any time benefit you might get from that helicopter.
Where you see the time advantage, I believe, is in between facilities when you're minimizing the amount of time that the patient's out of a physician's care. And that's probably the time where the service where I am, where we urge a helicopter transport, is in between facilities where you've got like a an aorta that's threatening to rupture, and you really just want to minimize the time they are not in a facility. I think that's where the helicopter buys you time. But I agree, it seems like it takes, with some scene flights, it certainly seems to kind of dilate things.
Well, you look at some of the cities like Jacksonville, Florida, I think, or maybe it's Tampa, they've established a no-fly zone. Basically, they've plotted out how far 30 minutes drive is, and you don't do that. The British do that. Also, they have a 45-minute, 45-mile rule, and what Bob Bass and the MIMS people did after the crash of Trooper 2, and actually before that, they established these no-fly zones that are around their eight trauma centers in the state of Maryland, and unless there is an entrapment or some ingress-egress issue, they go by ground, and perhaps that's what they need, but again, because helicopter EMS is untouchable by the states because of the Airline Deregulation Act, you can't specify anything. In Texas, we tried to specify the requirement for air conditioning, and we were told by our attorney general that you can't do that because all federal law trumps state law, and hopefully the bill that Susan was talking about and going into Congress will address that.
Well, how about if you can't do it by state law? How about if medical directors do it by protocol?
I get challenged.
Yeah, they
by,
do.
By who? By who?
By federal. By the operators.
But
it's already happened.
The medical director doesn't operate on the operators. The medical director operates under the EMTs and paramedic who works under his orders.
Well, some of the services will actually hire a medical director who's already an EMS medical director for the community, and naturally they get those flights. And other services will go into a community and hire somebody who's influential EMS, or hire their spouse or their domestic partner as an employee, and so that they really fly under the radar. You know, you actually, as a medical director, you get you know, these queries from your EMS department, EMS fire chiefs, EMS division chiefs, saying, "Hey, listen, we really want to use XYZ helicopter because they came by and visited us, and we think they've got better equipment." Or, I mean, there's a constant undertow to usurp whatever authority a medical director has, and of course, that varies from state to state.
And there have been legal lawsuits, not necessarily an individual medical director decision-making, but in states that require CAMHS accreditation to be operable in that particular state, we've seen operators come in and sue. And that's fairly common. It's just kind of one of the drivers behind some of these other congressional initiatives, but it is happening.
Yeah, well, you know, the South Carolina, I believe, had a certificate of need process, and they were using that to keep a particular operator out that didn't meet standards, and of course they lost in federal court. Exactly. The state of Tennessee tried to require some avionics on aircraft, particularly coming into Vanderbilt, but other hospitals, and they were sued in federal court by an operator. And of course, the verdict was, you know, federal law trumps state law. And so, you know, even in Texas, they went to the attorney general to ask whether these subscription programs were a form of insurance, and basically we've been told that that too really is, you know, you just can't touch these air ambulance operators, and they know it. And
I appreciate that you can't get them in the legal arena, but you know, if you're the medical director and those people on the ground are working under your license, you can make all the rules you want for them, and the air ambulance operators don't have standing, as best I can tell, to challenge your medical protocols for your ground ambulance.
Well, that's true, but there's so many medical directors in this country who are so passively involved in EMS, they just sign the forms, you know, and they leave it up to the paramedics to write the protocols. Now, I want the paramedics involved, but, I mean, they're just basically a figurehead, and that's almost the rule rather than the exception. I mean, great cities like where you're at, Skip, and some of these other places where you have an engaged medical director, yeah, it can work, but you know, a lot of these areas that are served are rural areas, and there's not any significant part of medical oversight because there's no money to pay the medical director.
Now there's a national issue.
Oh, that's an issue for another podcast. I'm adding it right now.
That issue came up at the NTSB hearings as well.
What's that?
A national oversight for EMS. There's no federal home for EMS directors, so to speak. So it's all state by state. And there was some discussion about, you know, how that could evolve.
One of the things I heard, at least in some of the press things, like on National Public Radio, was several comments from both physicians and pilots talking about the pressure to fly, more indirect, but that constant feeling that they have to fly to make ends meet. Is there the desire or the push within air medical, similar to as in ground, to move from a transport-based compensation system to a readiness base? And would that help some of the safety issues to remove the business pressure of flying to get revenue?
Yeah, but doesn't Maryland have that? I mean, they are a state-funded air medical program.
Well, Maryland does have that. They charge $11 per auto tag, and they don't have the competition. New Jersey has something similar, but you know, the director of the division of CMS that oversees ambulance reimbursement was called to testify, and really he was pretty uninformed. We just have these 8 pay scales, and you know, there's no evidence that they're going to change. Now, I will say this: I do know that the private side, the third party payers, have had several meetings looking at this very seriously. I know they're certainly starting to reject more of these flights, and I wouldn't be surprised to see a significant cutback in reimbursement. The problem is, you know, what that does is throw the baby out with the bathwater. We need helicopter EMS. We need high quality helicopter EMS. It's part of the EMS system. And if you take reimbursement completely out of the picture like that, then it's going to hurt services that have been the legacy providers and operating the you know, the larger airframes with VFR and night vision imaging systems and so on.
Well, and I'll throw out the grenade into the crowd. I personally believe that a lot of these flight services are airborne billboards for their respective whatever they are, hospital, local, whatever. And, you know, I think that, you know, they're willing to give up $10,000 a flight if they can get their name out there and know that they're going to recoup it, because they're going to get, you know, 100 flights out of the service this year and know that, you know, I'm going to go give them free swag. And I think that that's where they become the airborne marketing department of whatever system they're a part of. And I even told Kathy Mayer that, and she didn't deny that. And
air services are... they're a loss leader, and this was actually studied. There was an article about 3 years ago, I think Rosenberg was the author, in Journal of Trauma, and they actually looked at, you know, the downstream revenue generated by the University of Michigan survival flight. During the fiscal year that was, I think, 2001, it cost about $6 million or so to operate the entire University of Michigan survival flight. But what it did, it generated $62 million in downstream revenue for the hospital, not counting physician fees. And they found that people transported by helicopter were more likely to be from the suburbs and thus more likely to be insured. And this all follows a model that was described in 1985 in the Harvard Business Review for survival of the hospitals in the coming years. That is to develop a captive patient flow model. It started with helicopters, and then as soon as they could get it, they started building the regional hospitals. And there's really no altruism there. It's all about getting patients to the hospital. Hospitals are businesses, and they're actually very, very well-run businesses.
Yeah, because they wouldn't be in the business if they didn't make money. I mean, let's get honest with that. Even the Sisters of Charity, even though they're a not-for-profit, they still are mostly in the black.
I think the official term, Chris, is FPS, not swag. Free plastic, I can't say the other word, or we'll title, free plastic stuff.
Well, the hats aren't plastic, they're cloth most of the time. And you get a calendar sometimes, too.
Don't put facts and data into the...
Okay, sorry. I'm trying to keep it at least honest, partly. So... what do you think the outcome is, Brian and Stacy? What do you think the outcome of this is? Do you think we're going to see less air medical helicopter based systems in the United States? B, do you think they'll be more fixed wing, or is it going to become more incumbent upon ground services to provide these services?
Well, if I could just say, I think that the outcome of the NTSB hearings is really not of any. And I have a high respect for the NTSB because they're the only investigative agency that's looking at this critically, although they're limited by Congress as to what they can do. I think the outcome is what you're seeing, that what's happening at a national level with AIMS kind of imploding between the nonprofits and the for-profits. You're seeing family advocates stepping forward, and so you're seeing more push for change at a groundswell level. And that's how it's going to play out, because AIMS, the industry, is somewhat imploding upon itself based on their various different initiatives. The NTSB is probably going to come up with some recommendations as a result of these hearings within the next month. Those recommendations will go to the FAA. The FAA will either accept or reject them. They will take their own sweet time in implementing them or going through a rulemaking process. So that's a given. But I think what's more interesting to study is what's happening at the national level with the different for-profit and non-for-profit models. And that's where we're going to see it all play out in Congress.
I agree with Stacy. I think that there's an adversarial relationship between the NTSB and the FAA. But I have spoken with some of the board members, the actual NTSB board members, and they're dead serious. You know, they actually went way out of their scope of general investigation for the NTSB hearings. You know, and they did make recommendations in 2006 that really weren't implemented by the FAA. And even at the hearings, the FAA said, well, things really aren't that bad. But I see now in the media they're starting to backtrack. I think that at a minimum, I think they're going to require certainly, you know, terrain avoidance warning systems, night vision imaging systems, more strict criteria for dispatchers and dispatching. They may go IFR. That's real controversial, but that's the general impression I got, is they may require, you know, the aircraft be IFR capable with IFR pilots. I don't think we're going to see dual pilots. There may be some requirements for minimal airframe size. In other words, you know, mid to large twin engine aircraft. But the problem is the NTSB is just can make recommendations. It's up to the FAA. That's the reason it's important that this bill that Stacy mentioned, if it makes it out of committee, well, first of all, it's important you notify your congressman, let them know you want the bill out of committee, and make sure that the Congress actually votes on it. Because if we wait on the government, on the FAA to make any actions, we could do this podcast in 2015, and we'll be talking about the same issues.
We certainly don't want to do that. I just want to clarify, there are a couple different bills out there because of the stratification within the industry. There is there's language in the Senate that is based on the NTSB's recommendations. There's going to be new language in the House that's somewhat similar. And then there's some of the patient medical necessity stuff we've been talking about tonight that is in a new bill. So that's part of this stratification and implosion that we're seeing, is we've got a lot of special interests kind of saying, hey, wait a minute, this is the way to fix it. No, we're looking at this. And then we've got a whole group of other people running around freaking out over what could potentially happen and trying to align themselves. So it's become a very interesting power play. And I think we have to wait and see how it all settles out. Because there are actually more than one or two bills out there. There's potentially three, and we need to educate people on what the differences in those bills are. It's going to be very important to do that.
Now, do you think, is it along party lines, or does it really matter?
No, it's along for-profit and non-for-profit and family advocate lines.
Okay. So the parties themselves don't really say, oh, we're not for this because it's bad for business, or we're not for this because we're protecting the taxpayer, or...
Well, I think that some of the for-profits are definitely going to say that this is, you know, a regulatory... It goes against the basic principles of America, which is, you know, everybody gets a piece of the pie, and we should all be able to play in the same sandbox and get a piece of that. And so... There's going to be a very heavy push on the for-profit saying, you know, you can't limit my ability to work in a particular state.
Sure we can.
Well, we can, but, and so it's
we
very
do it all the time, and the Democrats are in charge now. We can do it more than we used to be able to.
And there's lots of people trying to do that. And there's alignments being made, and it's all good. I think it's all good because, you know, look at, you know, it's a move for change, and we're not waiting for the FAA.
So, Skip, I know you've got something to say about that. I mean, what in your estimation, guys, do you think is going to, what is the ultimate conclusion? What do we want to see?
Well, I would like to see, you know, this appropriately taken care of legislatively, which means the states get put back into the business of regulating this piece of the practice of medicine like they regulate all the other pieces of the practice of medicine. But I don't know. It's something in my makeup makes me think that if we don't take responsibility and deal with it first, then we have not great moral standing to demand others to do it. And I think we need to, chiefs and medical directors, folks on the ground, all need to take an ethics course, and they need to address this issue. And somebody just needs to tell them, calling a helicopter because it's a two-hour ride to the hospital is bogus, except in the most rare case. And keeping your ambulance in service is no reason to put additional lives and limbs at risk.
And I would like to say that, you know, we can look at medical necessity, and we can limit the helicopter usage state by state, but if we don't put some basic technology on these aircraft, if we don't look at some of the basic stuff that isn't being done, technologies to help pilots get out of trouble when they're in trouble, you know, it doesn't matter how much we've limited state by state the number of helicopter flights.
I guess I would take a different view. I think it would. Because I think a lot of this action at the margins is folks who are in it for a buck and don't want to invest in what it takes to do the job. And if you take away the unnecessary volume, then the margin isn't there for them.
Some of these have got some very large fleet, big margins. You can
take away some of it, and what we're relying on is a state-by-state
system to say, you know, through some sort of a process, whether it's an RFP or whatever. I mean, it's hard to get your arms around how each state is going to manage their helicopter volume and their flight volume and who they're going to pick and choose to do that. And one would hope that they would make the right choices. But at a minimum, at a baseline, we want 06 NTSB recommendations. We want TAS. We want... we want a proper flight risk evaluation done. We want to look at weather very closely. No difference in weather minimums, whether a patient's on board or not. Those are some of the basics that are getting overlooked in all of this kind of implosion. So what we're saying is, let's go back to the 06 recommendations. Let's add night vision goggles and look at a couple other things that are possibilities. And then let's add some of this other stuff that we're talking about tonight. But, you know, let's look at the basics and get the basics correct.
Well, did I read correctly not long ago that operators who have tried to add night vision goggles have been unable because the market can't supply them because they're all going overseas?
I've talked with Mike Atwood, who is the president of the company that supplies night vision goggles for the majority of these helicopter operators. The problem is not he has them on his shelf. The problem is an FAA delay, and it was misreported by CNN. And if anyone, you know, this is the thing. It's about a four-month process to train your crew and to equip your cockpit with the goggles at this point in time. That's the delay. They're not all going to Iraq. You know, that's the misreport. What the problem is that the FAA, and it's the approval process, is taking up to 18 months plus those 4 months of training time. So that's what we need to look at. We need to separate what we read in the media from what is actually true, ask those important questions, and that's the reality of night vision goggles.
You know, to follow what Stacy said, one of the most striking things I thought about the NTSB hearings was the very first panel, you know, was Dr. Ira Blumen from the University of Chicago, and a guy from the Helicopter Association International, and then the Canadian that came down to talk about their service. And Ira gave a bunch of information about the number of helicopters, but he actually calculated, and he probably has the best data available, the risk for air medical crews, and it was something in the neighborhood of like 117 fatalities per 100,000 employees per year.
164.
Mm-hmm. And that was that was higher than commercial fishing. Now, one of the mantras you hear is, well, ground ambulances are dangerous. Well, yes, ground ambulances are dangerous, and we're all alarmed about the accident rate. But when you compare apples and apples, and Brian McGuire, when he was at GW, studied that. He found that the rate for ambulance people is around 13 to 14 by 100,000 per year. And another thing I like to do, they said, well, healthcare is dangerous. Yes, healthcare is dangerous. But we're here to talk about helicopters. And, you know, it really is a dangerous endeavor. The problem is, and I've talked to a lot of these paramedics, in fact, as I get a lot of emails, they always begin the same way. Dear Dr. Bledsoe, please don't use my name, but, and they go on. But, you know, I hear stories like, you know, this is the best job I've ever had. I love flying. I think I'm making a difference. But I actually had a paramedic about 3 months ago tell me he has a pilot he's scared to fly with because the pilot's been making some bad decisions, he thinks. And I said, what about the one to say no? And he goes, well, yeah, but if you say no, then there may be, you know, repercussions. And he said he actually went in and complained to the director of operations about the pilot, and basically said, you know, paramedics are a dime a dozen, replaceable pilots aren't. Suck it up or quit. And you know, that's not a common thing, I hope, but you know, I've heard it enough times to know that it's certainly present in the industry, and if Skip were to do that where he works or these other ground providers, you know, we would hear about it. But because, you know, this is a cherished job, and it's a fun job. I mean, I was a flight paramedic. I love flying in helicopters, but the emotion's taken over.
I think, too, Brian, it's not necessarily those people that are placed in those situations that are really unfortunate, but it is the crews that maybe get complacent, too, and are kind of over-trusting of the environment in which they're flying, and the program itself perhaps pushes weather minimums and, you know, makes those decisions on a regular basis. And so you do have complacency flying in certain types of situations that if you worked elsewhere and saw a different model, you would kind of be horrified. So, and I'm not reading into my sister's situation, but she did work in an area where regularly they flew in pretty bad weather, and it was kind of commonplace. And I wonder if that played into the fact that was what they did there.
Well, when you take profit out of it, it makes a difference. I actually, 3 or 4 years ago, I was in Sydney, Australia, and rode with a friend of mine to Keyser Smith Airport, where the air medical wing is for New South Wales. And the purpose of the meeting is that the flight paramedics were complaining because one of the hospitals and a particular part of the New South Wales ambulance was calling them for patients who really didn't stand to benefit from helicopter transport, and they wanted it stopped. You know, that doesn't happen here, except for maybe in Maryland and New Jersey, because that's contrary to the capitalistic model.
Well, it's also, you know, somebody made a good point a second ago. This is just another aspect of EMS where we have people who will make bad decisions because it's fun. Look at how many folks will run an ambulance that has no business needing a siren with a siren on and speed through traffic when there's no indication to do that. And if you do a root cause analysis and drill down into their brain, it's because it's fun.
Kathy, you've been remarkably quiet. You're our resident flight nurse in the crowd. Do you want to say anything about what we're talking about, or are we hitting the nail on the head? Are we off base?
No, you're definitely hitting the nail on the head, and not only as a former flight nurse, but also as a former regulator of flight services in my state of Wisconsin. I agree, there is no there's no guidebook for us when I was approving these services. You know, I would look at their protocols, I would look at their medical direction, I would look at their location. We had them do a needs assessment. You know, it was really difficult for another service to get started.
Oh, we just lost Kathy.
Right there.
Oh, there you are. Okay, yeah, we just lost.
Yeah,
we had to. You said that new flight services had to. It was hard for them to get started, and then we lost you.
Very, very hard for them to get started. There's no help from the federal government to try and tell me, as the regulator, as the person reviewing their operational plan, what I need to look for. It was all kind of hit and miss, and just. Flight nurse, I kind of knew what to look for. I knew what the service that I flew for did as far as safety, weather minimums, you know, all of those kinds of things. The service I was with before, very safe service, you know, great flight record, all those kinds of things.
So they had a good, they had a good.
Say, you know what, it doesn't need to go by air ground.
So can I ask, when you were on a flight service, did you actually land and say, yeah, I think they can go by ground? Was there any pressure on you?
Yeah,
really? Yeah. Wow.
Really. Absolutely, there was pressure. I mean, my employer didn't like it, but there really was no need for some patients that we would respond to, you know, especially seeing flights. If they had a capable ground service of the right level, there's no reason for us to take them by air. The problem in my state in Wisconsin is that we have a lot of basic services. We don't have that many paramedic level services. So we use the helicopter around here.
Okay. Wow. That's very admirable that you would actually land and go, I think it can go by ground.
Well, I know the University Hospital in Madison does that. It's a physician staff service out of, and they'll go out and land and Help assess the patient and put them in the ambulance, and they'll get back in the helicopter and go back to the house.
Wow. That's great.
I'm friends with several of their doctors, and I've had them at my hospital, do the same thing. They're very bad. They're good at questioning that, I guess, now. And the service that I was flying for was actually based in Minneapolis, but I flew out of Wisconsin and near Richmond and Rice Lake for LifeLink. And they were very good about never telling the pilot what kind of call it was. The pilot had to make the judgment based strictly on the weather, could we go or not go. And we strictly adhere to the, one to say no, three to go kind of policy. So safety was our biggest thing.
So Brian, or Dr. Bledsoe, sorry. And
call me Brian.
Okay, Brian, sorry. I don't know you. I'm the only person in the crowd that doesn't know you. But Brian and Stacy, any final thoughts? And then I'm going to let Gary wrap up the Washington idea of what's going on up there, and then we'll wrap the podcast. Any final parting thoughts?
I'll go first, because Stacy really should have the last word on this, because she's earned it. First of all, I want to say this is not about the paramedics and the nurses or even the pilots on these aircraft. They are doing a job. They are helping people. They're truly trying to make a difference. It is all about business and unbridled business that, in the name of profit, is pushing the safety margin. It needs to continue, but it needs to continue in a safe fashion, and it needs to be used reasonably. There needs to be more oversight, both from a medical standpoint and from a regulatory standpoint. And somehow, some way, we've got to get it out of our paramedics' mind that, the indications for a helicopter is the presence of a patient. We need to really work on those criteria and make it better. And I think that's the message. We don't want it to go away. We just want it to be safe. We don't want to have any more Aaron Reeds or any of these other people who, give their life trying to help other people when it probably didn't have to happen.
And Stacy?
Well, I thank you. And Chris, I did want to offer up my sympathy and condolences on the loss of your father.
Oh, thank you.
About to do that?
Interesting story. I wasn't gonna really mention that, but
sorry.
No. Well, he actually four days before he died, he actually was flown from the small mountain hospital he was at to Denver. And I was in the room with him, and the doctor came in and said, "Hey, we're gonna fly you to Denver." And I kind of looked at the doc and I went, "At least it'll be a nice flight for him." So, to the credit of the crew, they were great, and they came in. I talked to him a little bit, and they're like, "Yeah, we'll sit him up." And really, did he need to go by helicopter? Probably not. But you know what? It was the thing he talked about for the next 2 days, and it really it was amazing. So, but thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I do want to just, we've talked a lot about the nonprofit and the for-profit models, and one maybe being, a safer model because it is a non-for-profit, and then there was some discussion that non-for-profit is actually not necessarily non-for-profit. I think we need to look very closely at medical necessity split by those two types of business models and question that. That's just a precaution for, the bills that are coming out. My sister worked for a not-for-profit that had two fatal crashes and then destroyed three other aircraft after that. So I'm not real, I'm skeptical. But one of the things that I do think is that she did dedicate 28 years of her life to this business, and she joins a lot of other family members of people just like her, just as dedicated, and she lost her life unnecessarily. And so we do need to continue to put the pressure on all fronts with, the bills that are coming forward, regardless of whether we all agree or disagree. I think that's a really good thing that we're doing this and that people are taking the initiative to do this, that the NTSB is shining the light on this, and that Congress is going to start hearings most likely in March on this issue. And I just want everyone out there who's listening to take a stand, to study what's out there, to learn these issues, and make a decision and write their congressperson, or make a visit and speak up, because we don't need to be here anymore.
I agree. I completely agree. And Gary, what do you see coming out of Washington? You said you wanted to wrap up the whole topic with that perspective.
Well, I want to tag on to what Stacy just said a little bit. Just as I don't believe there's one model of providing ground ambulance service that's clearly superior to another, I don't necessarily believe that there's one model of aviation medicine that's clearly superior to another, given the right circumstances. I do think it's true that today, as a general rule, the hospital-based providers are more adaptive to technology than the ones that aren't. But that doesn't mean it has to be that way. There are three things kind of going on the legislative front from the increase the safety groups that are working. I can't speak to the other group because they haven't been real public with what they might be working on. One of them is the legislation that Stacy talked about that she's working on that has to do with implementing the NTSB regulations with regard to TAS and night vision goggles and things like that. That is a piece of work that goes to the Transportation Committee and is directed squarely at the FAA and changing the regulations that they have. There is another bill that should be introduced soon that is also a jurisdiction of transportation, and it has to do with the issue that Skip talked about, which is states' rights and the role of the states, clarifying the role of the states and the ability to have things like certificate of need laws and regulating the personnel and equipment that are on board the aircraft. The third piece Dr. Bledsoe referenced early in the program, and that was a piece that was developed by the Patient First Air Medical Transport. So I'm happy to say that I'm part of that, where we took a stab at differentiating into levels the types of aircraft that are being used, both helicopter and fixed wing, and then also the levels of care that are currently provided across the United States. And they can be put into levels. And so that effort will eventually potentially lead to some work that might occur with an agency like Medicare to have the payment system recognize investments in safety and investments in the people that are providing care to our patients. So those are kind of the three things that I know that are going on. I think we'll see some continued dialogue between those that are spearheading all three of those efforts about whether it makes sense to have three separate efforts or not. But I think all three of those efforts play a real role in creating some very necessary change, addressing the FAA rules specifically, addressing the issue of states' rights, and aligning the payment system so that it has incentives for investing in safety and medicine. All three of those things, I think, are the right things to have going on. So I think we're in good shape in terms of what's going on. What actually happens, time will tell.
Okay. Well, you know, thank you guys very much for talking about this again. Stacy, you're just such a great and gracious person to come on and talk with us about this. Would you do me a favor and come on about every 15 episodes and keep reminding us why we need to be active in this? And if there's any updates, we'll gladly have you back, because I think that keeping this in the forefront of our mind is very important. I know that even this week I've met with a local provider here that wants to come in and provide fixed wing service because they think that all the helicopter services are going down, and they really think that because of this that it's just a writing on the wall is what they told me. So I don't know
fixed wing crashes in Colorado too.
Well, you know, and funny, the service that came here is a Learjet service, and I don't know how many jet services have crashed, but I know most of the crashes in Colorado have been turboprop or dual engine prop planes. So,
well, thank you,
Okay, well, thank you very much, guys. Dr. Bledsoe or Brian, would you, great, we love having you. Would you be willing to come back and maybe talk with us some point about medical directors and how we can make them more active in our service?
Sure. This is the first time I've been to the EMS garage and didn't get my hands greasy.
Yeah. Well, hey. Well, you know, it's about, you know, the original idea for the garage was to talk about things that we all talk about in the ambulance garage anyway. So that was the original idea behind the podcast. And we're staying there. We're at least staying very close to that. So we'd love to have you back anytime you want to join us. We'd love having you here. And as always, Kathy, Gary, and Aaron, thanks for joining us. I'm gonna and Skip fell off. I think he had too much scotch, maybe. and then Will had to go feed the baby, and Greg had to run to the medic cast. So thank you all for listening, and we wrap another EMS Garage this week. Join us next week. We're gonna talk more about just good EMS topics.
It actually hates Gold Cross, Gary's organization.
Why does your brother have such deep feelings about any EMS organization?
I don't know. I tell you, Thanksgiving is very interesting. So if he has his way, I will be unemployed.
I mean, did somebody put him in a traction splint and trap his testicle therein, or...